Here we are again. Welcome. This is lesson 27. This is known as the penultimate lesson on the book of Exodus. Penultimate meaning second to the last. So this is the penultimate lesson on this book that we're going to be working on. So next week we'll have, well, the next 2 weeks, we'll have one final lesson to wrap up the book. And so tonight we're going to be looking again at chapter 35, starting in verse 30, which really belongs to chapter 36, and then all of 36, 37, and 38. And obviously I'm not going to exegete all of it in detail, but I do want to go back and touch on some of the most important points. Now, step back from the book and think about it like this. Have you noticed how much of this book is dedicated to two topics? Two topics. Two primary topics in this book have been the Sabbath day, which was repeated four different places in this book, and then the construction of the tabernacle, which is, this is our fourth lesson on the construction of the tabernacle, with the previous three lessons that we looked at, constructing the tabernacle parts 1, 2, and 3, being God's instructions for building the thing. So you get the impression, don't you, from the book of Exodus, that what really matters to Moses in writing this book is not his own history, which takes up only a small part of the beginning. The Exodus itself is a key part of the book, but it comes and goes, and then the second half, or most of the two-thirds of the book, is related to events that take place after the Exodus. So you get a little bit of their wandering down to Sinai, but the majority of this book, at least starting in about chapter 18 or 19, somewhere in there, is where the people land at Sinai, and then the rest of the whole thing is what happens there at the foot of Mount Sinai. Because even these chapters are probably at the foot of Sinai, because the actual construction of the tabernacle would need to take place prior to the people leaving from Sinai to head to the promised land. God would have given them instructions, the three previous lessons, to build this thing that would house the ark, which would be constructed here. Into that ark would be placed the tablets of the law that they had now received from atop the mountain, and then they would march away from this place. So the work here of building this tabernacle is, in some ways, you might argue, is the event that now triggers their leaving from Sinai to go away to the promised land. So it's sort of, if you will, the topic of the book, the building of this tabernacle, which, if I might just make a simple application of it, and, you know, I'd be drummed out of the preacher corps if I didn't do this, but you see how important to God worship is. Worship is not a secondary act. Worship, the people coming under God's standards and God's methodologies, coming to what He ordains to be the place of worship and bowing before Him, that to Him is more important. But we've argued from a reform perspective that the fundamental reality of God creating human beings was to create and redeem a people that would worship Him. That fundamentally the human race was designed to be a worshiping people, to bow before His eternal majesty as He reveals Himself to them, and the result of that, them being to worship Him, to understand and receive and honor His glory forever and ever. That was the reason we're here. Now, that doesn't cross the mind of virtually any evangelical in our day. I mean, if you stop and think about it, how much evangelical theology is built around the idea that worship is central to what it means to be a believer? It's not. What is it? Well, it's about our personal enjoyment by virtue of escaping from this world to get to go to heaven when we die. That's fundamental. So it's really more me-centered than it is God-centered. But a Reformed theology always begins at the center with God, which means that it's all about His purposes. Thus, the construction of the tabernacle, its instruction, and then its construction is all about the people being reminded in a very physical sort of way that the one thing that God has purposed to do is to build a world with a people that He would call to Himself to worship Him, to come and to know Him. As I said this morning, the chief end of man, to glorify God and enjoy Him forever. He being the key idea of what it means even to be human. So that's kind of what this chapter is about. It's about these men now stepping up and building this thing that is symbolic of the very core of the relationship between God and His people. Worship. Worship. Now, we are introduced then to the two men. At the end of chapter 35, we're introduced to the two men who will be set to do this. The first one of them is a man by the name of Bezaleel. He is the son of Uri, the son of Hur, of the tribe of Judah. And God sets this man apart by the Spirit of God with skill and intelligence and knowledge and craftsmanship to do the work. Now, let's just pause for a moment here. We had a little bit of a discussion last week about this, so let me just remind us of what we talked about. I am convinced that these men possess certain natural skills that God amplified greatly to accomplish the task of building this tabernacle. I admit that it's possible that God might have supernaturally given to Bezaleel all of these abilities that he never possessed before. That is a possibility. It could be read that way from this text. But I'm inclined to think that God, in fact, didn't do that, because if you think about so much else that God does, God doesn't just miraculously impart into us what he wants us to have, but rather he uses what we call means to accomplish those ends. For example, we don't believe as Reformed people that you're converted just because God shows up in your living room one day and says, you're a Christian now. What does he do? He uses other human beings to accomplish the task by preaching the gospel, the preaching of the word, the ordinary means of preaching, the ordinances, the church, missions, those sorts of things to accomplish the task. So God can certainly supernaturally empower someone with these works, but it's more likely that God used the pre-existing ability in Bezaleel and fanned it, if you will, by virtue of the Spirit to bring that to fruition. I think, for example, in my own life, prior to becoming a preacher, and I've only been a preacher now for about 15 years, but prior to that, I spent a lot of time teaching in secular environments. When I was working for the software company in Birmingham, I did a lot of road travel and a lot of in-house training. So I had spent a lot of time in front of people, you know, doing what I'm doing now, lecturing, instructing, that sort of thing. So I had natural skills to that. It wasn't a far jump then to move to preaching. It took some additional training, obviously, some additional learning, which would then fall over into the ability to communicate in this particular subject. But I don't look at it as God just supernaturally gave me an ability to preach all of a sudden. And frankly, I've not met many men like that, if any, to be honest with you, that suddenly just one day just start preaching because they've never done it before. It's typically not the case. What does God do? He takes the ordinary abilities of men and he supernaturally empowers them by virtue of his Spirit to imbibe that and create in that something that he wants. Okay, so he gave these men skill and intelligence, or this man, I should say, skill and intelligence and knowledge and craftsmanship to do this kind of work that would be needed. And it even goes so far in verse 34 to suggest that he inspired him to teach. Inspired him to teach, because I think what he gave him was not only a supernatural ability to use the gifts that he had to accomplish this massive task, but also an ability to pass that knowledge on to others. That's what teaching is, right? Taking what you know and passing it on to others. The measure of a good teacher is not how well he communicates, it's how well his audience understands him so that they can understand that and learn it and then potentially pass it on to someone else. And so he's given this ability to be able to teach as well. He would need this. And the reason why is because he would need to be able to delegate. Now, there's another individual who is mentioned in verse 34. That's Aholiab, the son of Ahishamach of the tribe of Dan. So we have one from the tribe of Judah and one from the tribe of Dan. And it says in verse 35, he has filled them with skill to do every sort of work done by an engraver or by a designer or an embroiderer or whatever. In other words, they would have the skill level from whatever natural skill they possess, now empowered by the Spirit of God, to be able to oversee a group of people accomplishing all the different tasks that would be necessary. In many ways, you could say that Bezalel and Oholiab become the contractors, and they're the ones who now understand what all the subs need to do, because they have skills in those areas, but they're going to be delegating the work, because these two men are not going to be able to accomplish the task of building this entire thing. I mean, it's going to require weaving and sewing. It's going to require carpentry. It's going to require metallurgy and metalworking. It's going to require design, architectural design, although the image was given, but you still got to lay it out. You still got to measure the wood and cut and make it all fit together and work together. So there's all those kinds of things that would be needed. So these two men are given this ability to delegate to all these other people that would be part of the project, and then they would oversee the project. So there was going to be a team that was going to be involved in doing all these things. All the people that would be necessary to fabricate items out of wood, gold, silver, bronze, various kinds of fabrics, embroideries, all the other things that God had specified. And you remember the instructions that God had given were very detailed. And so there's a pattern to be followed, which, as I pointed out last week, puts a great deal of pressure on these two men. You got to get this right, because this is how God has said it's supposed to be done. This is the pattern that was given. You need to do that. Now, as I look over this chapter and a half, or these several chapters on this, you will notice that Moses is really not mentioned directly here. Now, remember, he's writing this text, okay? So he's looking at this from the perspective of sometime later, probably during the 40 years of wandering, which is still future yet to this, because remember, the events as they follow are the people leave Sinai, they head towards the promised land. As they get close, the 10 spies go in. The 10 spies come back and say, we can't go in. God then curses them to wander in the wilderness. So they come back into the Sinai Peninsula, and they stay in the Sinai Peninsula for 40 years before that generation falls. Okay, so that's still way off in the future. It's probably during that 40-year wandering after the spies that Moses actually sits down and writes these books. So he's writing what he recalls. He's writing what he remembers. And he remembers in this time that he himself was not the guy leading the task, right? He's not the guy who's going to be leading the project. He is going to be the spiritual leader, and or I should say, continue to be the spiritual leader of the people of Israel, and he has delegated the responsibility down to these men to carry on the project. So Moses isn't going to be the primary guy, and that's okay. In fact, that's very okay. Because these people are still going to need a spiritual leader, but God has purposed to put the construction project on to Bezalel and Oholiab so they would lead it. And so he's simply supposed to delegate the responsibility. Now, at this point, I could do my whole Nehemiah sermon about how you need to delegate and make sure that everybody's doing their job because that's an effective leader and so forth sort of thing, right? That ordinary stuff that you hear all the time, which is pretty much out of our culture now. But nonetheless, there it is. Moses goes, yeah, I'm not going to try to get involved in this project and build it. I'm not qualified to build it. I don't have the skills. But these two guys do. God has obviously gifted them to do it. So I'm going to delegate to them and leave it up to them. In fact, I think that as you read chapters 36, 37, and 38, you get the very distinct impression that Moses is not around at all. It's almost as though he's off in his tent somewhere and every once in a while wanders over probably to see how it's going. Taps Bezalel on the shoulder and go, hey, how's it going? Bezalel goes, hey, don't bother me. I'm busy right now. And Moses goes back to his tent. But that's okay. Now, all of that is sanctified speculation. I don't know if that's true or not. Moses may have hung around every day to watch because he probably felt a great deal of responsibility for what was going to take place. I mean, after all, he's the guy that had come down from the mountain with the pattern. And so as he's communicating it to Bezalel and Oholiab, he wants to make sure that they would do the job the way that they're supposed to. I also had you look and make a comparison to the New Testament office of deacon, because I do think there's a parallel there. I've often said, and I'm continue to argue, that the New Testament is a foreshadowing of the Old, more specifically in the work of Christ, of course, but nonetheless, there are still aspects of church life that find certain prerequisites or certain symbolisms out of the New Testament. And one, I think, is the issue of the deacon. Somewhat ironic that I was having a very lengthy conversation with a number of men on Friday about the office of deacon, because I went to a Deep South Founders Conference board meeting up in Jackson, and it was attended by a number of other pastors who are involved in the leadership of the Deep South Founders Conference, and we were making our plans for our conference coming up in January. Jeffrey Thomas is coming to preach, and if you haven't made plans for that, let me encourage you to do it, January 21st and 22nd up in Jackson. I'll get you more information, but it's going to be on Good Works this year. But nonetheless, we were talking about various churches, and one of the things that Carrie noted, he said, it's interesting that Southern Baptists are really, really good at organizing. It's what we do really, really well. But the problem with Southern Baptists is they organize so well, they organize themselves to death. That you quite literally find churches, and I didn't mention this morning in the various things I was talking about, splits, but you think about how many times splits find themselves coming out of the deacon body of a local church. Have you noticed that? How often that the splits don't start in just the congregation. They start in the leadership, which is often delegated to deacons. You see, this model that's so prevalent in Southern Baptist churches is not a biblical model. Here's what happens. You have the typical Baptist church is made up of a pastor, one particular staff person, and then a group of deacons, most of whom don't qualify to be to possess the biblical office of elder. They don't have that natural teaching ability and those other kinds of things that are spoken of as the higher level of elders. They don't possess that naturally. No offense to any of you, but the idea being that most churches, the deacons are not necessarily qualified to be elders. I just as an aside, parenthesis. When I came here and I interviewed with the deacons, you remember that? Remember that interview? I went to my wife and I said, in most Southern Baptist churches, those men would be elders. In most Southern Baptist churches, those men would be elders. If they had elders, but that's what I'm saying. They would be elders in eldership-led churches. But the idea of having a deacon body is this idea of you have a group of men who are not qualified to be elders, but guess what they wind up doing? They wind up acting as pseudo-elders or de facto elders. They're running the church. But because they're not running the church from a spiritual direction, but only from a administrative direction, it's easy to split. Because it's easy to find disagreements over administrative matters, isn't it? It's very easy to do that. I can disagree with Ron about how the lawn should be cut, right? You should go this way and this way, not this way and this way. Yeah. See, but your opinion is wrong. But that's my point, right? We can disagree easily over administrative matters. It's what we do. When you have a spiritual cohesion amongst a group, it's a lot harder to disagree because your foundation is built on something other than just, well, a personal opinion. Now you're basing it on something deep and spiritual. Okay. So in this particular case, Moses is still going to stand as an elder over these men who are doing this work, this team that's doing this work. And he's still going to have to shepherd that group so that it doesn't divide. And this is the point in the church today. The role of deacon is to be a role in which the group of deacons recognize themselves as servants in a purely administrative fashion, not to direct the goals and visions of the church itself. Because the problem is that when you make administration of those kinds of things the vision of the church, you lose the church. It's not the church anymore. So it's easy to split it. It's easy to disagree over something in that regard, and then the church isn't the church anymore. It becomes much more cohesive when you have a spiritual body in that place. So the deacons carry out the work of doing the kinds of things that are needed within the body in terms of the physical labors needed, but the oversight of that must always be from a spiritual level. So Moses is standing there as the elder. And remember, it's not just Moses acting as the elder here. Let me just correct that. It's Moses, but it's also Aaron the priest and his sons. Remember, they were also established to be the spiritual leadership of the people. So Moses isn't alone in this. We sort of think of him as that way, but he's really not. So the office of elder and deacon in the New Testament finds somewhat of a symbolism in the Old, in this picture of Moses, a spiritual leader, delegating down to these men to carry out this job. It's interesting that I learned about one church. How many from familiar with Capitol Hill Baptist Church, Mark Devers Church? Okay. They have 30 elders and hundreds of deacons. But they don't have an official deacon body. Virtually anybody can be a deacon. And what they do is they simply hand responsibilities to different individuals in the church, and they serve in a sort of quasi-deacon mode in that sense. And so Dever even allows for women to serve in that capacity because he's not creating an actual deacon body. An interesting debate amongst the pastors at this little conference about whether that was the right model or not. I don't think so. My impression is that you really do have an Acts 6 picture of a group of men who are set aside to a specific task. I could point you back to this chapter as well and say, look, God set aside certain individuals, certain men that he established for this kind of role under the spiritual leadership. He didn't make it some sort of quasi group. In other words, Moses, or better, God, didn't come along and say, now, anybody out there have any talent in building something? Oh, so you have some carpentry? Okay, good for you. We need you. And then what about you? You have any skills in weaving? Okay, you come. And then what about this lady over here? She has some ability to do something. He didn't do that. What did he do? He went and he found specific men with specific gifts. He then supernaturally empowered those gifts and set them aside to it. So I'm inclined to think then from that model that the New Testament model is more of a specific group of men set aside to that task, but not inclined to be some sort of visionary leadership in the church, but rather simply pragmatic leadership in the church, making things happen in the body and doing it. Okay.
Now, if they want to go outside of that body and delegate somebody, to do a certain thing.
Of course.
That's okay.
Which we do, yeah. Right. We do have people outside of the deacon body that are doing a number of things. Like we have Lori acting as the hospitality coordinator and Gwen as the breakfast coordinator and so on. So we do have other positions that we have in place. Debbie is the food coordinator and so forth. But we're not making those three ladies deacons. We're establishing them in ministries in the church. But we still have a cohesive group of men set aside to it. And of course, we also believe they should be ordained. I mean, we should lay hands on them and set them aside to that task so we know who they are and establish them in that role. And I think that's the biblical position. But one of the problems with much of Baptist life is it had a tendency to swing so far over here to the idea of a deacon being much, much more than what was originally established in Scripture, to the point where they became quite literally the leaders of the church. The very first church that I pastored at, I'll never forget it. When, after about a year and a half of struggling with the deacon body, I asked one of the deacons point blank, I said, do I work for the congregation or do I work for the deacons? And he said, oh, make no mistake about it, you work for the deacons. It was at that point that I realized my time here is going to be short, as it was. Okay, so God sets aside these two men. He puts them into a gifting so that they're prepared. He builds a team around them through these men who then go out and find the other people who will do the work for them, which leads then to the very first problem that comes, and that is they begin to receive the contribution of the people for the materials. You remember that God had said, we looked at this in the previous lesson, that God had put into the hearts and minds of all of the people in Israel to be generous with what they had brought with them from Egypt to apply to this project. And again, as I just noted, it's stuff coming from Egypt. They possessed nothing while they were in Egypt. They were slaves. They owned nothing. But when they left, they plundered Egypt. They took gold and silver and bronze and wood and cattle and who knows what else, because Pharaoh basically says, take all you want and get out because, everything's being ruined. So they did. And every man went and plundered whatever he could. So every man is carting, if you will, whatever he has taken out of Egypt, the spoils of Egypt, with him. And God now puts it into the hearts of the people to bring what would be necessary to build this project. And so they come, and they come, and they come, and they come. And they're bringing lots and lots and lots. Verse 3, and they received from Moses all the contribution that the people of Israel had brought for doing the work on the sanctuary. They still kept bringing him freewill offerings every morning, so that all the craftsmen who were doing every sort of task on the sanctuary came, each from the task that he was doing, and said to Moses, "The people bring much more than enough for doing the work that the Lord has commanded us to do." So Moses gave command, and the word was proclaimed throughout the camp, "Let no man or woman do anything more for the contribution of the sanctuary." In other words, thank you very much. We've got all we need. Now, it's a good problem to have, right? I mean, how many churches find themselves with an overabundance of stuff that the people are willing to give for the operation of the place? It doesn't happen that often. More often than not, most churches find themselves in a situation where they have to borrow in order to build or whatever. It's rare that you find this kind of generosity in the lives of the people in the amongst the people. They were simply too generous. But we know why, right? As we speculated in the last lesson, the only reason they could have had such generosity is because the Lord put it in their heart to be generous, because they would have never given it in the first place. If God hadn't poured out a spirit of generosity upon the people such that they realized the importance of what was being built and they were willing to part with the stuff that they brought with them, they would not have brought anywhere near what was needed. But they did. Now, I find it interesting that the various craftsmen come to Moses and say, you know, we have enough. I don't think it's a complaint. It's just a, hey, we have enough, thank you very much. I really don't think it's a complaint in the sense that they're whining about the fact that people are bringing stuff. It's hard to complain about generosity. It's always easy to complain about lack of generosity, but when it comes to generosity, I don't think they were complaining. I think they were simply saying to Moses, the Lord has blessed us, and these people continue to bless us, and it's great, but we need to do our jobs. We can't spend all day trying to get through all the stuff you're bringing us. We have work to do, so we can cut the tap off at this point. It's a good problem to have, because God opened their hearts and God moved in them such that they would give everything. Now, I had you notice last week that in verse 10, it says, he coupled five curtains to one another. Okay. And in the ESV, that he has a little footnote next to it where it says probably Bezalel and then compares it to 35:30 and 37:1. And you will notice all the way down this section is a singular pronoun, he. It is highly likely that the he is, as the ESV notes, Bezalel, the guy who's mentioned. And the reason is because if you read the structure of this text, starting in 35:30 and working down, you will see Bezalel is the guy who is doing this project. He's the chief guy. Aholiab is behind him in the project, but he's the guy. And so the he is undoubtedly him all the way down this page. And so it says he made curtains and he made the upright frames and he did these things. And it goes all the way down through 37:1, 37:10, 37:17, 37:25, 29, 38:1, 38:8, 38:9. You will notice the he is repeated again and again and again. And I think that the reason is because Moses is, as I said earlier, is disconnecting himself and giving this responsibility to Bezalel. And so the project is under his leadership and he is taking that project and he's running with it. Moses is delegating the responsibility and going down the page with it. And I think it's another way for Moses to actually give credit where credit is due. You know, it would have been easy, if you're writing this much later, right, to write this down. Well, we made this, and then we made that, and then we did this, and then we did that. And theoretically, that would be true, right? I mean, Moses wouldn't be writing a lie to say that, because indeed, as he's overseeing the project as the spiritual head of the people, and Bezalel's doing the job, and then all the other people below him, there's a plurality of individuals there. So a we would work. That pronoun would be fine. But Moses doesn't do that. Moses specifically writes he and all those references. What did I just quote you about 12 of them? He gives credit where credit is due. He establishes that it is Bezalel who's the guy who's going to be able to stand before God and say, I built this. But as we speculated last week, there's the flip side of that. I mentioned it a minute ago. There's a tremendous amount of pressure here on this man to get this right. If you have three full sections of the scripture prior to this in which God gives instruction on building this thing, and now it comes time to actually start sawing wood and hammering nails and putting gold where it needs to be, you better get it right. Because Bezalel is not actually answering to Moses. He's answering to the Lord, to the God who had established the pattern. It is God who establishes the pattern, and then the one he delegates a responsibility to then answers to him. Moses was simply the go-between. It's Bezalel that's going to have to answer for how well this thing turns out and whether it turns out rightly. Now, there's a parallel that I want you not to miss. And the parallel here is when God set out to establish a world, create a world, and then redeem a people to it, who did he delegate the responsibility to do that? And then answer to himself. Got quiet all of a sudden. It's because the Father delegated it to the Son to do. Right? The Son comes down in John, in the Gospel of John, what does he say? I've not come down to do my own will, but I've come down to do the will of the one who sent me. I'm not doing what I want to do. I'm doing what he wants to do. So Jesus, in a sense, is much like Bezalel. Bezalel, in some sense, is a foreshadowing of Jesus. A Jesus who says, listen, I've come into the world, been sent by the one who has given to me the responsibility to do this. And so I need to do it according to his pattern and not to my own. Kind of explains why he sits in the garden or kneels in the garden just before his arrest and says, if there's any other way, and then says, but not my will, but thine be done. Yes, yes, I know we could probably redeem a people in another way other than a bloody cross where I have nails driven through my hands, but if this is what you have purposed, then this is what I will do. So the Son, from the beginning, has been delegated the responsibility to do all of what the Father has purposed in his decree. Have you noticed that? You'll notice that every single aspect of the decree of God is established to be accomplished by the Son. By the Son. The Son, it says in Colossians, created all things. Right? I am convinced that it's the Son that came and formed Adam from the dust of the ground, the second person of the Trinity, who showed up and created this man and breathed life into him and said, okay, now you are the first Adam. I'm going to be the second one in a few thousand years, but you're the first. And it's the Son then who takes on the incarnation, who enters into the human condition and lives as a human being and then goes and dies and then ascends to his Father's right hand. But it's also the Son who's been seated on the throne of authority and power. It's the Son who's been given the name above all names. It's the Son who will eventually return and establish a judgment that all men will stand before him. And then whose kingdom will it be? His. The Father has delegated to the Son every aspect of all of this, which is why I could say what I said this morning, in that our primary joy, our primary purpose should be in Jesus. Because he's the one who is creating and sustaining and redeeming and glorifying and consummating all things. It's him. So he is the source, he is the object of all of our affections. He should be the object of all of our joys. All of our glory should go to him. He is the one that we should be worshiping. I mean, after all, we pray in his name because he is the one who stands above us as the one to whom we have any opportunity to even come before the Godhead with a need. You see? So when the Christian church decides to stop making Jesus at the center and puts just some generic idea of God at the center, it loses the entirety of this story, the entirety of this narrative from the beginning. That the Father gave a people to the Son wrote their name in the Lamb's Book of Life. It's a reference to the Son, who would be the Lamb. And so their names are written there, they are included in him, and then he comes and accomplishes everything for them all the way to the end. So the church is about Christ from beginning to end. Everything's about Jesus. Everything is about this one who has come, who seated at his Father's right hand, then entered into the world, lived, died, was raised, ascended, and will one day come and get glory. It's all about him. And I think it's most important to understand that one of the most significant realities of what Jesus did was that he did what he did out of absolute and utter loyalty to the decree that God had established. He was utterly, he took that responsibility onto himself and said, I will do what we as the Godhead have decided to do. The Father has decreed it, the Son accomplishes it. You see that? So our focus is on the Son. The Spirit is sent by the Son to finish the work of the Son. Jesus said, I will ask the Father and he will send the Spirit. The Spirit will come and finish what I have started and accomplished in this world. But what does the Spirit do? The Spirit does not draw attention to himself. He draws attention to the Son. Turn to the Son and look to him as the one. Okay? So to me, as I look at this passage on Bezalel, being this man who has delegated all this responsibility, he has delegated a responsibility to build a place of worship. And he would answer to the Lord for how it looked. And the Lord would give him all of what he would need to accomplish the task. Those are all parallels in Christ. Christ would come. He would have all of what he would need to accomplish the task. He would do it according to the plans of the Father. And it would be a place of worship. Because what is the Son doing with the elect? Bringing them to the Father to worship the Father. Bringing them to the Father that they might be a people who worship. You see the parallels? The Old Testament is not just some story that was written to help us get to the New. It helps us understand why the New Testament makes the sense that it does. So even in passages like this, you can see the parallels if you're looking for them. God set aside a man and gave him extraordinary ability that he would use to accomplish a task of bringing a worship to God. And so he did. Now, just as a practical matter, look at the items that are constructed, right? That question number 4 there, right? The longest question in the history of my Bible studies took 3 chapters to answer. Okay, so what do we have? Now we have a number of items, that are created in a certain order according to this text. Number 1, the tabernacle itself, which starts with the curtains. So you notice it starts with the building of the curtains, and then the frames and the bases and the veil. The veil also being a curtain, but you construct the basic tent of the tabernacle itself. More than likely what Bezalel did is he went and found the weavers and the sewers and the embroiderers and said, you guys get to work on this task. Here's all the purple and scarlet yarns. So you begin weaving and building these drapes, and I will get this group of people over here to start building the frames and the bases and all this sort of thing. So he starts with the tabernacle itself. Then it says he builds the ark. He constructs the ark itself, and then he begins to construct the various accoutrements of the tabernacle that are placed in the various places. You've got the table of showbread and the lampstand and the altar of incense. Those three items are going to be in the holy place. The ark is going to be in the most holy place, back behind the veil, but these three items are going to be in the holy place. They're going to be outside the veil, so that the priest could daily go to the showbread table and put the bread there and work with the lamps and work with the incense. Remember, every day they were supposed to burn incense, and even today, Brian read from the section about taking care of the incense every day, that he was supposed to do that every day. Okay, so that's all going to be outside the Holy of Holies in the holy place. Then he constructs the altar of burnt offering. Now, that's going to be outside the tent. Okay, it's going to be at the front door of the tent, outside of the tent, though. And, of course, we've mentioned many, many times the reason you do that is because you really don't want to burn animals inside the tent, because you're going to burn down the tent if you do that. So you put that altar outside the tent, and that would also be where the people could come and offer their sacrifices then on that. There outside also would be the bronze basin. Of course, that's where the priests would wash themselves as they would perform the sacrifices. They would use that for the ceremonial washings. And then finally, around the whole outside is the courtyard walls, the linen walls that would be made that would stand 150 cubits long by 100 cubits wide and take up this space all around. So people could come in to the courtyard and they could come to the altar. And they could mill around then in front of the altar there while the sacrifices are being burned, and the priest could do his work from the altar. And remember, a lot of the work that's going to be done inside this courtyard is teaching. It's going to be very much like we would consider worship today, having a lot of teaching going with it. The priest would stand behind the altar and teach the people. We see pictures of that later in the Old Testament. So they could mill around in the courtyard there. Most of the people would never go inside the tabernacle. That itself was reserved for the priests. And then, of course, into the Holy of Holies, only for the high priest. And then only once a year was they allowed to go into there. Okay. So he would put this in this order and built it in this order. But it's different than the order that's laid out in chapters 25 to 30. If you go all the way back to the beginning, when God first started giving instructions on this, the instructions are first the ark, then the table of showbread, the lampstand, and then the rest of the tabernacle. But this order is different. And I think the reason why is because Bezalel builds it in a logical order, a logical, architectural, a structural order. The first thing you want to build itself is the tent itself. You put up the veil. Okay, now, what's the first thing you're going to put into that thing? Well, first thing you put in there is the ark. So you build that. They put the tablets in. They put it inside. And then he builds the three items that are going to be in the other side of the veil in the holy place. And then you build the altar outside. And then you build the courtyard around the whole thing. That's a logical order of construction. If you start with the ark, where do you put it until you have the tabernacle ready? See, if God says build the ark first, and then here's the constructions for the tent itself later, now you've got 3 months while you're embroidering all these curtains while here's this beautiful ark sitting here. Well, no, the right way to do this is first build the tent, then build the parts that you put together with it. Now, this is simply him making it. He's not actually going to erect it yet. That's the last lesson we're going to look at in next week, where we actually erect it. So in this part, he's just constructing it. But I think he does construct it in an order, in a structure that's logical, at least in my mind. I could be wrong about that, but I don't think so. Okay. In verse 21 of chapter 38, it says that the records of the tabernacle of the testimony, as they were recorded at the commandment of Moses, was the responsibility of the Levites under the direction of Ithamar, the son of Aaron, the priest. So in other words, one of Aaron's children who, as I mentioned a bit ago, was part of what I would call the spiritual leadership of the people, took the responsibility to make an account for everything that was used to construct the actual tabernacle itself. In other words, you need a bookkeeper in all this too, right? You need an accountant as a part of it all. Why? Well, frankly, you got a lot of stuff here that needs to be accounted for. All that the people brought needs to be accounted for so that we always know what is being used. And the bottom line is, we're not talking about people here who are inherently perfect. They are ordinary people. Some who might have had a little bit of a thieving heart and who might have said, you know what? They're not going to need this little brick of gold here. I'll take this back to my tent. And so the accountants are there for the same reason you would have accountants in any other business, is to account for everything that's coming in. There's no assumption in this text that all these people that are working on this project are sinless. There's no assumption in that text anywhere in here. Now, the other reality here is that by putting it under the responsibility of the Levites, you remember, were the neutral tribe in Israel. They were designed to be the tribe that would sort of be on the outside looking in, because it's from the Levites, you remember, where the priests would come. It's the Levites who weren't given a specific plot of land, but rather would infiltrate and live amongst all the other tribes, and they would serve as the priests. They would be the ones, the priestly caste, that particular was particular line. So they would be the ones to be thinking about all of the stuff that's being brought in for the construction of this tabernacle, thinking about it in terms of, we are keeping track of this in order to honor the Lord. And there were a number of record keepings that were surrounding the tabernacle and eventually the temple. There were a number of recordings that took place around the tabernacle and the temple. Remember the census tax that we talked about earlier? Where everybody 20 years old and up had to come and give a half shekel. Brian described it this morning in his reading. That had to be accounted for. Everybody who was supposed to bring needed to be accounted for. The Levites would be part of that. The records for that census would be kept in the tabernacle, in the tent of meeting. Later, when the temple was built, the various censuses and so forth were kept in the temple. And one of the other most significant things that was kept in the temple was the ancestral records were kept in the temple. Who was related to whom was kept in the temple. Matthew and Luke have in their gospel accounts two genealogies of Jesus. One coming from Abraham down to Jesus in Matthew's gospel, and one going backwards from Jesus all the way back to Adam, through Abraham back to Adam in Luke's gospel. Where do you think they got that information? They didn't just know it. They could research it. They could go to the temple and get it. And that, to me, has always been a significant thing, because once the temple was destroyed and the records were destroyed, that meant that no one after that could ever come and prove his lineage to David. So no man since 70 AD has been able to say, well, I'm descended from David, so I'm one of those Christ, I'm the Christ, I'm related to David. You can't prove it. No Jew living in Israel today can demonstrate their lineage going all the way back to David, because their lineage is cut off at 70. No one knows. Those records were destroyed, which is another reason why I think the temple was destroyed in 70 AD. It was for God to say, listen, I have sent you the Messiah. You don't need to look for another one. I've already taken care of the details. So this accounting that you see here is really the beginning of a large number of them that will be kept track of. You remember that when the great revival broke out under Josiah, why did it break out? Because they found a copy of the law written in the temple that they were remodeling, or going back and repairing, because it had fallen into disrepair for many years. They found a copy of the law, and Josiah read it and said, wow, we need to turn back to the Lord. So there were lots of things being kept in the temple as a storage. The tabernacle would be the forerunner to that. They would use it in that way as well. I'd be willing to bet, I'm not a betting man, but I'd be willing to bet that quite a bit of those records were stored in the altar itself. You remember the altar was hollow, right? And so they would put the shovels and other stuff inside there, but they would probably also put the records in there. It was big enough that it would hold those kinds of records, and then, you know, the four men would grab it on the poles and away they would go with it, at least until the temple was built. Now, I asked this last question about how much gold, silver, and bronze was in this thing because I want you to notice just how big this thing really was. Okay? It says, according to this, that there were 29 talents and 730 shekels of gold contained in this, which means there was more than 2,000 pounds of gold, more than a ton of gold used in this particular thing. There's about 75 pounds of gold in a talent, we believe, and about 2/5 of an ounce in a shekel. And so when you add that all up, it comes to 2,193 pounds. That's a lot of gold. And you remember that gold was all over the frames were covered with it, the ark was covered with it, the altar, the lampstand was made out of it, hammered out of a single piece of it, and so on. And so it, imagine that lampstand must have weighed a whole lot. When you think about a solid gold lampstand that probably stood about 4 foot high, made out of solid gold, how many guys do you think it's going to take to carry that thing? It's not going to be light. But that's the kind of the point. It has a gravity to it. Get it? Okay. Silver, 100 talents, an additional 1,775 shekels is about 7,500 pounds. So we're talking 4 tons of silver being used in this thing. Each base under the tabernacle frame weighed a talent, weighed 75 pounds. So they built a base, 75 pounds, and they would sit the tent pole in that base. And there would be, I forget, 10 or 12 along each side. So somebody's got to pick that up and carry that 75 pounds from here to wherever we're going. 70 talents of bronze, which is also not light, 5,300 pounds of that, more than 2 tons, 2.5 tons of bronze just by itself. And I don't know how much the curtains weighed, but given the way that they're described, they've got to be heavy. They're thick and heavy. They've got to be heavy. And they've got gold weaved into them, on top of that, plus the fact they're made out of yarns, various colored yarns and so forth. So they're probably very thick, which makes sense, right? So they got to dismantle this thing and pick it up and carry it and then reassemble it wherever they stop. Now think about that. A day's worth of travel, however far you would go, take 1.5 million people marching in this direction, stop for the night, and then these people all run out and reconstruct the thing. And then in the morning, tear it down, here we go again. Now, you think about 40 years of wandering in the wilderness, 40 years of wandering in the wilderness, times 365 days. How many times did they take down and put up that tabernacle? And carry the thing. Carry the 7 tons of gold, silver, and bronze, and then turn around and have to put it all together all the time. That's quite a thing. But what's the point? It matters. It matters. God said, I'm going to go with you. I'm going to go with you. And my house is going to travel with you, and you're going to put focus on that. And I'm going to come and meet you at this tent of meeting. And so I think that's the reason why it is so big and so heavy. It reminds these people, look, we're not just worshiping some God that you can carry around like a small statue in your pocket. We're following a God who is great and mighty. And so the very size of this tabernacle creates that impression, doesn't it? You can't get away from the idea you're worshiping a majestic God when you got to carry around an 8-ton tent every day. The silver, you remember, came from the 603,500 adult men that were aged 20 and up, as I talked about a minute ago, that was taken as the part of the census tax from chapter 30. Each man, 20 and up, had to give 1/2 shekel every year. Doesn't matter if you're rich or poor, you owed 1/2 shekel every year. And this 603,000 compares back to Exodus chapter 12, which is the point at which they're leaving, you remember? Since the period of time elapsed from Exodus 12 is only about 1 year of time. So from the time they left, marched to Sinai, camped at Sinai, and then constructed this tabernacle after Moses had come down with the instructions, after the golden calf event, all that kind of stuff, is only about 1 year of time. It's interesting, isn't it, that we think about this book as being, oh, this must have taken years. No, one short year of time. In fact, in chapter 40, in verse 1 and 2, it says, on the first day of the first month you shall erect the tabernacle, the tent of meeting. Which first day of first month? The next first day of the first month. There's only been one other reference to the first day of the first month, and that was all the way back there in Exodus 12. And so that's 1 year from there to here. Now, I point that out because the 603,500 men would not have changed significantly in 1 year. I mean, what percentage of the population was 19 at the time that they left and now is 20? It wouldn't have been that significant. There would have been a number, of course, out of 600,000 men, maybe, 5%? Tops would have crossed over from 19 to 20, and that's really, really generous. So maybe 500 guys. So it's not that significant of a number. But the reason I bring that up is because this is a group of people who know this. They've been involved in this process from the very beginning. And so we're not getting to some point where these people are going, oh, we're supposed to build a tent? No one told me about that. No, we've been talking about it for the last year. And so now Bezalel completes the job, establishes it, and builds it. And the Levites, as it says starting in verse 21, record all this. And I suspect that maybe Moses probably went to the Levites when he was writing this and said, do you remember how much gold we use in this thing? And they would look in their records. Yep, that's how much. Do you remember how much silver? Yep. And he writes it down. And I think he writes it down in order to make sure that everybody understands the gravity of this thing that they were building. But nonetheless, all of this is the construction of a tent, which would be the single most important thing that the Israelites would carry with them in the wilderness. The single most important device. Everybody would have their own personal tent and their own personal property, their own goats and sheep and all this other kind of stuff. Everybody would have that. But as a people, this tent would sit at the center of their existence. In many ways, you could make the argument that the people of Israel would be distinct from all of the other peoples on the planet because they would be the only ones who had such a thing. Only ones who had such a thing. Remember, it's mobile. It's designed to be mobile. Temples are not designed to be mobile, are they? No, when some pagan nation puts up a temple, and people go to the temple and worship in the temple. I've seen many of them. When I went to Greece and Turkey back in 2005, I walked through hundreds of temples, most of whom, which were on the ground at this point, after several thousand years of history. But nonetheless, massive temples. In fact, some of them are huge, unbelievable in terms of their size. And so this little thing is entirely different in the sense that it was mobile. What's the point? Where you go, I go with you. Where you go, I go with you. And where you're going is where I told you I was sending you. And I told that to Abraham. I made him a promise that that land would be his and his descendants forever. So you're going there, and I'm going with you. And if you haven't caught the parallelism yet, let me once again point it out. See, you should get good at this after a while. When the Son of God came down from his Father's throne, what did he say? I'm going where you're going. I'm going with you. And I'm even going as one of you. which is what's greater than the tabernacle. Because the tabernacle itself housed the presence of God. The presence of God in some sort of spiritual sense. But now the Son of God comes and says, I'm going with you. And so I'm coming down to become as one of you. And then I'm going to tabernacle in you. I'm going to send my Spirit, who's going to reside in you. And the New Testament, I love the way the New Testament puts it. The New Testament writers often call the third person of the Trinity the Spirit of Christ. The Spirit of Christ. His Spirit. The one sent by the Son. He comes and indwells in us. I find the modern evangelical idea of asking Jesus into my heart to be boorish and cliche, because it doesn't come anywhere near to understanding what it is that the Spirit of God is actually doing within us. It isn't just Jesus came into my heart. It is Jesus has sent his Spirit in order to go with us. Where? Into his presence. So this is a tent being built for the purpose of God going with the Israelites, the chosen people, to where they're going. But God has sent a far greater tabernacle to go with us. And it doesn't weigh 8 tons. It's the Spirit of God. And Jesus, I think, even, I can't prove this, but why does Jesus say, come to me and take my yoke upon me, for my yoke is light? Those Israelites had to carry a 8-ton tabernacle around. We take a nice, and yeah, right. But we take the Spirit of God, whose load is light upon us, because it's him doing the leading. Now, I know I'm pressing that analogy a bit too far. But so what? So what? Okay, so we will come back next week, Lord willing, and we'll look at the final chapters of the book of Exodus as this temple is erected. Now, there's one more thing that needs to be done, though, before we can build the tabernacle. I mean, before we can erect it. We've built it now, but there's one more thing that we need to do. One more thing we need to do, and that's encountered in chapter 39. And that is that we have to give Aaron and his sons their robes. Those also need to be made and placed upon those men. And so we'll see that also as part of our final lesson from the book.